Nothing can ruin a summer picnic or a walk in the woods like the whining buzz of mosquitoes, and then that moment when you know you're being bitten. In many parts of the world, mosquitoes are more than just a nuisance. They carry diseases like malaria, which affects approximately 250 million people and kills about 1 million people every year. Mosquitoes are our topic today on Please Explain, from their buzz to their bite, and we are joined by Joseph M. Conlon, a retired U.S. Navy entomologist and the technical advisor for the American Mosquito Control Association, and by Thomas W. Scott, director of the UC Davis Mosquito Research Laboratory and professor of entomology. Welcome to Please Explain.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tom, do we know how long mosquitoes have existed?
Well, we make an estimate that it's somewhere around 150 to 200 million years ago was when they were derived, and probably at that period of time might have been feeding on dinosaurs and then ultimately changed to feeding on other hosts, including humans.
So are they all bloodsuckers? Is that a part of being a mosquito?
No, actually, they're not. Some of them don't take the blood meal, and it's only the female that takes a blood meal in order to get the amino acids and the proteins that are necessary to develop her eggs.
So it's only when she's pregnant that she's likely to bite us?
No, they pregnant in the sense that she's been inseminated.
Mm-hmm.
No, some of them feed before they mate, others afterwards, and then they'll take repeated blood meals. For each egg-laying batch.
So should we feel good about the fact that we have been nourishing baby mosquitoes? I mean, I don't know how many eggs she lays.
Well, it depends on the species. There's about 3,500 species of mosquitoes. And of those, there's a relatively small portion that bite humans. They feed on a variety of different hosts. Some of them are specialists, and they'll feed on just a certain species. Others are more generalist and will feed on a variety of them. So of the ones that feed on us, there's relatively few. I don't know. I think it's up to you if you want to feel good about them biting you. Most people wouldn't feel good about that, though.
Joe, how many species do we have in this country?
About 176.
So not that many, but that's still, and most of them bite humans?
As Dr. Scott said, most of them can bite humans, but we definitely have some specialists. Dr. Scott alluded to the fact that there's at least one species or at least one genus of mosquitoes that don't feed on blood at all, the Toxorhynchites, and we've got several of those species. But as he said, there are several species that prefer to feed on birds, some that prefer to feed on reptiles, and some that prefer to feed on humans and mammals, and it's those are the ones that we're most concerned about.
And what do the non-bloodsuckers feed on?
Just plant juices and nectar.
And that's
they can actually be quite good at pollinating themselves.
And that's all to feed the young. What do they eat?
That's exactly what they eat. They utilize that for energy.
And the males. The males who are in the same species as the blood-sucking females, absolutely no implication meant for humans. Those males, what do they survive on?
They survive on plant juices and nectars also. Their sole purpose in life is to mate, essentially.
Are mosquitoes found on every continent, and are they in some areas more than others?
Wherever you find decent temperatures and wherever you find water, you're bound to find mosquitoes because all mosquitoes require water to live. We found mosquitoes breeding in the Himalayas at 14,000 feet. We found them breeding in mine shafts in India down at 2,000 feet. We find them in the various deserts around oases. One of our worst problems with mosquitoes, actually, is in Everglades here in Florida, but another great problem we have is up in Alaska, up in the tundra areas. There are just staggering amounts of mosquitoes get hatched out every summer, and there have been documented cases of asphyxiation from caribou ingesting, just inhaling mosquitoes because they're so thick up there.
I'd always imagined that mosquitoes only thrived in hot, moist areas.
Oh, no, no. They're extraordinarily adaptable, and as Dr. Scott said, they've been around for 150 to 200 million years precisely because they are so adaptable. So we've got some relatively cold, hardy species, and that has something some implications with regard to disease transmission, too. A lot of people think that diseases such as malaria, dengue, yellow fever are tropical diseases. Well, they're tropical diseases because we force them to be tropical diseases now because we don't allow transmission in the United States. Dengue fever, which is also known as breakbone fever, was first described in Philadelphia in 1781 by Dr. Benjamin Rush. And there have been numerous yellow fever epidemics all the way up to Boston, Massachusetts. So they thrive quite well in this particular type of climate. And every year we've got malaria cases occurring in Finland and Russia and places like that. So it's a common misconception that they're just hot weather critters.
Well, Tom, to some degree, isn't that because they seem to pop up in the spring?
Well, yeah, they would. They would only be, you know, the mosquito is exothermic. That is, its body temperature is dependent on the environmental temperature. So, during the winter time, they would be in a dormant phase, and then when things warm up, is when they would become active, go through their development. The adults would emerge and start blood feeding.
And they seem to be especially prevalent in the evening. Are they nocturnal?
Well, that depends on the species. Some are crepuscular, where they would feed at sunset or sunrise. Others are nocturnal, that would feed through the night. There's some species that transmit malaria that have adapted to feed late in the evening, like between 11 or 1 in the morning, when people tend to be sleeping and they wouldn't be as behaviorally defensive. But then there's other mosquito species that feed during the daytime. The Aedes aegypti, the so-called yellow fever mosquito that also transmits dengue virus, is a daytime biter. It bites people in the daytime when they engage in their daily activities.
Would somebody who's sophisticated in this area be able to distinguish between different kinds of mosquitoes
by
looking at them or listening to the sound of the buzz?
Well, you can tell by looking at them. I think it's we have fewer people that have expertise in the taxonomy of mosquitoes than we did in the past, and that is a concern because you want to be able to direct your interventions. If you want to try to prevent a disease by reducing the population densities of vectors or shortening their lifespan, doing something like that to interfere with pathogen transmission, you have to be sure that you're directing it at the proper target. And we have fewer people that have that kind of expertise than we did in the past. But then there's some species that are what we call cryptic species. They look identical morphologically. They look identical to one another, but they actually are distinct populations that don't interbreed. And there are several cryptic species that are involved in the transmission of malaria. So it becomes really quite important to know whether or not you actually have a vector species in an area or not, or if you do, where exactly would you want to direct your intervention to try to kill that particular population.
What causes the mosquito's buzz? Are they flying very fast?
It's their wing beat. It's the sound of their wings beating. And there's some actually very interesting research that has come out recently that indicates that the male and the female use the sound of their wing beats to find each other. They actually change the pitch of the wing beat so that they harmonize, and then they do that before they mate.
My guests are Thomas W. Scott, director of the UC Davis Mosquito Research Laboratory and professor of entomology, Joseph M. Conlon, a retired U.S. Navy entomologist and the technical advisor for the American Mosquito Control Association. We're talking about mosquitoes on today's Please Explain here on WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Joe, where do they lay their eggs? We are told usually in little pools of water. Is it usually fresh water, or can they also lay their eggs in salt water?
This is dependent upon the species. We have several species of mosquitoes that breed in salt marshes, they breed exclusively in salt marshes, and these tend to be some of our more pestiferous kinds, because when you have a neap tide or the really high tides during the year, the areas where they lay their eggs get inundated, and they come out in staggering numbers. And one of the big problems we have with the salt marsh breeding species is that they've got extremely long flight ranges, up to 70 miles.
Wow.
To find them inland searching for foods. So they're a big problem. each one of the species of mosquitoes, the 176 species we got, have different breeding proclivities, and they'll lay their eggs in particular types of either containers or temporary pools, depressions in the ground. And it's very, very important, as Dr. Scott alluded to, that we know which species we're dealing with, because we can predict with some degree of accuracy where they are breeding. And one of our best methods of controlling them is to eliminate the breeding sites when we possibly can. Freshwater, the more organic content you get in the water, the more some species of mosquitoes, particularly the one that transmits West Nile virus in the urban areas, likes it. They like polluted water. There are some species that like fresher water. But it just depends upon a species. But the thing is that all mosquitoes require water to breed, and they can breed in incredibly small amounts. I found Aedes aegypti, the yellow fever larvae, breeding in discarded Coke bottle caps. So they don't need a whole lot of water. So if you're trying to get rid of sources of mosquitoes, you have to be very, very fastidious about it.
How many eggs does a female lay in her lifetime?
In her lifetime, it could be as few as 100. It could be as many as 400.
And how long do they tend to live?
As Dr. Scott said, it's generally about 2 or 3 weeks, but there are some species that overwinter. As adults, there are some species that overwinter as larvae, frozen solid, as a matter of fact.
And what are they doing when they're not out looking for blood? Are they do they sleep in certain places?
You know, they hide and rest in certain places, and that's important to know where they do that, too, because you can eliminate those places. Like in brush, heavy brush, they tend to like that. Myrtle, ground myrtle around gardens, they like to rest underneath there, or they like to rest underneath decking and things of that nature. So, yeah, they're just marshaling and keeping their flight resources to a minimum.
Tom Scott, what's the mechanism that allows them to bite through skin and suck out blood? Is this like sipping soda through a straw?
Well, it's a very interesting process. They're almost like a phlebotomist, a person that would draw blood from your arm with a blindfold on. And they have their mouth parts have evolved to have various structures that they have one set of structures that actually opens a wound in the skin, and then they have another one that inserts mouth parts down into the skin, and then they start probing. They go up and down in kind of a conical fashion until they lacerate a venule and blood starts to come out. And when that happens, they can detect that they've found blood. And then what they try to do is to cannulate a venule, to actually go into it. And like you said, then they would suck the blood out. But they don't always do that. And sometimes they'll just collect the blood that accumulates outside the circulatory system. But they actually have substances in their saliva. So while they're doing this, they're putting out a little bit of saliva that interfere with the clotting process. So they're sort of fighting the capacity of our body to prevent the blood from coming out so that it makes it a little bit easier for them to find it.
Is that what causes the itch later?
The itch is due to the proteins that are in the saliva, so we have an immune response to that.
And what attracts them to a food source? Is it heat or smell or color or pheromones?
It's a variety of things. It's probably not just one thing. They probably use different cues at a longer distance than they do when they get close. So they may use visual cues at a distance and look at contour or movement or shape. As they get closer, or if it's a nighttime feeding mosquito, they may rely primarily on olfactory cues, so smell. And it would be things like carbon dioxide in our breath, or lactic acid, also heat or humidity. What they do is they sort of fly in a zigzag pattern, and when they in the course of doing that, they have hairs on their antenna that will detect these things, these chemicals, and when they detect it, they sort of move back and forth, detecting a gradient of concentrations and move closer until they get to the actual source. Then when they land, and if you're ever inclined to do this, you can watch, they'll land and they'll just sit there as if they're waiting to see if there's a behavioral response, and then if there's not, they'll start tapping with their mouth parts, and then insert them and go through that process that I talked about just a moment ago.
You're giving me the willies just talking about it. Joe Conlon, Anne in Manhattan asks a question that I think a lot of our listeners are about to ask. Why, oh, why do mosquitoes always bite me and not my husband?
That's a $64,000 question.
Well, is there something on our skin, or is there some smell that they're responding to? And is it true, as I've heard in the past, that mosquitoes are more attracted to women than to men?
Some mosquitoes are. The research that's been conducted in this has come up with a lot of varying results. There's about 300 different semiochemicals that the humans release from their body. Some of them are attractive to mosquitoes. Some of them are repellent to mosquitoes. So you've got 300 to the 300th power different combination of chemicals that you can exude just from, as Dr. Scott alluded to, your sweat, your carbon dioxide. But there's skin flora. You have bacteria on your skin that also emanate vapors that have particular smells to them. And some mosquitoes are attracted to these, and some of them are not attracted to these. The Aedes aegypti that we talked about, the yellow fever mosquito, is attracted to the lower parts of the body. And some people have actually conducted experiments showing that they're attracted to dirty socks and smelly feet.
So some mosquitoes will go after our legs and feet,
yes.
And others will go after our arms and our necks and our faces?
Yes, some of them prefer head feeding, and some of them prefer feeding near the feet. Yes.
Wow. We have to take a little break. When we come back, we'll be taking calls from our listeners. Our number is 212-433-9692. People are also leaving messages on our show page at WNYC.org. My guests are Joe Conlon, a retired U.S. Navy entomologist and the technical advisor for the American Mosquito Control Association. We'll get into controlling, I'm sure, as this conversation continues. Also, Tom Scott, director of the UC Davis Mosquito Research Laboratory and professor of entomology. We're talking about mosquitoes on today's Please Explain. And we're back with Dr. Thomas Scott, director of the UC Davis Mosquito Research Laboratory, professor of entomology, and Joseph M. Conlon, a retired U.S. Navy entomologist and the technical advisor for the American Mosquito Control Association. We're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. And our first caller is Caroline from Great Neck. Hi, Caroline. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. I've noticed a new kind of mosquito for the pet that last year and this year. They're smaller. They seem to have stripes on their legs, and they bite. I mean, they like cluster on you and they bite you all over, and it feels like you're going to go crazy. But then the bite doesn't last as long, or the itch doesn't last as long, and they're pretty ferocious. And I'm wondering if it's a new kind or just evolution.
It sounds like the mosquito you're describing is the Asian tiger mosquito. It's a very small, very, very dark black species.
Yes.
It's got a single white stripe down its back, so to speak, and stripes on its legs. It's a ferocious biter, will bite at any time of the day. This is another one that tends to prefer the lower legs, actually.
Yes,
and
I know.
This one breeds
that.
In containers, generally around the house, but it can breed in tree holes, too.
But they're Asian. How do they want to, in the United States, is globalization bringing more mosquitoes to more places?
Well, in this case, yes. As a matter of fact, they came in through the port of Houston in some used tire shipments from the Far East.
Now, haven't there been cases of malaria on Long Island in recent years? Is that another example of this sort of thing in action?
Yeah, we have cases of what is called airport malaria continually here in the United States, about 1,000 a year almost. And it's just from people coming in from other areas of the world that are carrying malaria with them. And then it's got a 14-day incubation period, and then they start showing malarial symptoms here in the States. In some cases, we've actually had malaria transmission within the United States. In Maryland, it happened several years ago. And I think we need to understand that even as late as 1935, we had 128,000 cases of malaria here in the United States that were transmitted. So malaria does quite well here in the United States. I think this underscores the fact that some of the worst diseases, vector-borne and mosquito-borne diseases in the world, are a mere 8-hour plane flight away.
Now, how does that work? Does the mosquito bite somebody who has the disease and then transmit it to the next person it bites?
In the case of malaria, yes, that's how it works. In the case of your West Nile virus, that's not how it works at all, because you can't transmit it from person to person by mosquito. It gets transmitted from birds to mosquitoes, and then the mosquitoes transmit it to the humans. It doesn't go beyond a human. So it depends upon the disease that we're talking about.
Is it true that lavender is a natural mosquito repellent, a listener asks?
Yes, but it's a very weak mosquito repellent. There are a lot of natural mosquito repellents out there, but by and large, in their natural state, they're very, very weak, and they have different volatilization characteristics so that they don't work very well for over periods of time. Things like oil of cloves is a spearmint, peppermint oil, are known repellents. However, their repellency only lasts a very short period of time, maybe 20 minutes or so. If you want the same type of protection you get from DEET, you'd have to use oil of cloves at about 50%, at which point the smell would be obnoxious and it'd probably burn a hole right through your skin due to the acidity.
Is DEET perfectly safe?
You can never say that anything is perfectly safe, but if used as said on the label, it provides a minimum risk. There was a 7-year study conducted a couple of years ago with over 6 billion, that's billion with a B, applications of DEET, and they found that there were 2 fatalities, and both of them were people trying to commit suicide by drinking it. So it's probably far less of an issue than you have with any of the normal medicines you take, Tylenol, aspirin, and things of that nature.
Tom,
protect you from disease.
Have mosquitoes and the parasites that they carry and the viruses they carry evolved together?
Well, to some extent that they have. I mean, typically what happens is that the parasites have a shorter life cycle, so they tend to track the mosquitoes. But you get to see a fine tuning of the relationship so that the parasite is more efficiently transmitted. And there can be some of these parasites that have a detrimental effect on the mosquito, in which case the mosquito may respond to that. Excuse me. But I think it's mostly the parasite adapting so that it's more efficiently transmitted.
We go now to Elaine from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I'm wondering if there have been any studies with regard to HIV transmission in mosquitoes.
There's been a number of people that have looked at that, and basically what happens is the virus decays within the mosquito as well as other blood-sucking insects. So it is possible that the virus could be transmitted mechanically. That is, the mosquito would stick its mouth parts in the person and then just have contaminated mouth parts and bite another person. But the concentration of HIV in human blood is so low that the probability of that is really quite remote. But in terms of what things like West Nile or yellow fever or malaria do, where the parasite actually grows or changes form inside the mosquito before it gets transmitted, that would not happen.
Thank you for your call. Tom in Williamsburg left a comment on our show page. He says, I've noticed that the mosquitoes here in New York don't buzz as much and sometimes not at all, as opposed to the ones in my native Sweden. Are you aware of mosquitoes being more buzzy in Sweden, Tom?
No.
Okay.
No, I mean, it may have just something to do with their wing beats, or it may be that people are just paying more attention to it there. Yeah.
A number of listeners are asking about whether garlic works as a good mosquito repellent.
Garlic's been tested on a number of occasions with regard to its repellency in humans. And as a topical repellent, if you use pure garlic oil, you can get about a 20-minute repellency for mosquitoes in a laboratory. However, nobody's been able to demonstrate that if you eat garlic or if you put garlic around your yard, it's got any repellency whatsoever.
Let's take
great on Italian food, though.
I agree. Let's go to Andrew from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I play volleyball for the Long Island Volleyball Association, and oftentimes we have big mosquito problems, especially when it's rained days before. We usually use mosquito repellent, and one of the members on our team pointed out that when we use a lot of mosquito repellent, it goes into our bloodstream and it affects our nervous system, which is what explains why sometimes we don't really play as well when we use a lot of mosquito repellent. Do you think that's true?
Who wants
mosquito
to answer that?
Mosquito repellent, like DEET, is indeed, some of it is absorbed into the bloodstream. It's excreted very rapidly by the kidneys, though. In terms of, you're probably sweating it off and you're probably applying too much because there are strictures on the label with regard to how often you should be putting DEET on.
Uh-huh. So it's possible, I guess, it might be affecting a little bit of our nervous system.
They haven't, no one's been able to identify a nervous system affected pathway that DEET would affect. So it's not been demonstrated in clinical studies.
A caller from Savannah, Georgia, Candace, left a comment on our show page. She says, as a frequent victim of mosquito bites, a friend recommended rubbing banana peel on my battle wounds. I don't know how it works, but it's the best remedy for the insult. Have you heard about that?
I have.
Banana peel?
No, I have not heard of that either. I've heard of a number of topical things that you can use as repellents, but it's actually to reduce the amount of insult to the body by the bite. There are very few things out there. Calamine lotion, your general antihistamines and your calamine lotions are generally the best for that and are recommended by doctors.
Now, a listener came up with an interesting thought. Since bats eat mosquitoes, and recently we've seen a serious decline in the bat population because of white nose disease, could it be possible that they're eating mosquitoes that are causing them to die?
While we don't know, it's unlikely. And I would have to provide the caveat that bats are not huge consumers of mosquitoes. All the studies to date have shown that you get between about 2-4% of their dietary intake is mosquitoes. They tend to be opportunistic feeders that feed on larger insects to provide a greater return for energy expended. So moths, June beetles, things of that nature. I can't speak authoritatively to whether they're eating mosquitoes that have a West Nile virus would affect them, but I don't believe so. And maybe Dr. Scott can elucidate that.
Yeah, I don't. I'm not aware of that. There is some evidence that animals can get viral infections from eating other animals that are infected with viruses. So there was some evidence with West Nile virus that some birds of prey may be getting infected by eating infected prey animals. So I suppose it's possible that if a bat ate infected mosquitoes, it could become infected. But I don't know of anyone that's looked at that specifically.
My guests are Thomas W. Scott, director of the UC Davis Mosquito Research Laboratory, professor of entomology, and Joseph M. Conlon, a retired U.S. Navy entomologist and the technical advisor for the American Mosquito Control Association. It's Please Explain, and we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Tom from Park Slope, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a big believer in biodiversity and that all species, whether plant or animal, have their place in the web of nature, et cetera. What would be the results if we came up with a method that was able to wipe out all mosquitoes and just so that because of the diseases they carry, et cetera, and that all mosquitoes were wiped out? What would be the first repercussion of doing something like that?
Well, first of all, that would be a monumental undertaking. I mean, there's some 3,500 different species of mosquitoes, and I think it certainly would affect food chains. In fact, there's some people with the fish and wildlife that are concerned about controlling mosquitoes in wildlife areas and the impact that might have on the production, for example, of waterfowl and so forth. So I suspect something like that would happen. In terms of the pathogens that they transmit, there are instances of those pathogens having some impact on the regulation of other populations. Typically what we think about, the people that are working on mosquitoes and the primary reason that we're concerned with them is because of the impact that they have on human health or on domestic animals and wildlife. So, for example, in my particular case, I'm interested in controlling only those mosquitoes that are associated with disease, and I'm interested in diseases that are in developing countries that have really an enormous impact. So, for example, dengue fever that I work on, there's about 3 billion people that are at risk, about 100 million people that get infected with clinical disease each year. Malaria in parts of Africa causes mortality rates as high as 30% in children from 1 to 5. So we really want to try to focus on that and try to reduce the human suffering that's associated with those specific particular mosquitoes. And I don't think removing them is going to, those particular species would have a dramatic impact on biodiversity.
We go now to Billy from Westchester. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, all. Providing the mosquitoes have a narrow territory, I had an idea of interrupting their breeding cycle of my backyard mosquitoes by putting out a large bowl of water and meticulously changing it every 3 days or whatever the breeding cycle is. Would that work?
And another listener asked, what's the best way to kill mosquito larvae in a pond? I guess we can tie the two together.
Well, given the fact that mosquitoes utilize, even the mosquitoes that are container breeders can utilize a number of different types of oviposition habitats, just putting that out in your backyard and drawing a few mosquitoes to it is probably not going to have a noticeable dent in the population. Although people are actively working on, trapping mechanisms to draw mosquitoes towards them, it's probably not going to really affect them in any way, shape, or form.
So, Billy, forget it, okay?
The swimming pool.
Yeah, just stay out of the swimming pool. That was an earlier segment that we did.
In terms of treating ponds and things like that, mosquitoes tend not to breed in the middles of ponds. If they're going to be breeding anywhere, it's going to be on the pond margins. And one of the things you need to do is make sure any emergent vegetation that you have in the pond margins is kept to a minimum, because generally there are indigenous predators in that pond that will take care of your mosquito larvae if they're allowed access to them. And the more emergent vegetation you got around the pond, the more that they are going to be hidden from these things. So that's one way of naturally affecting the outcome. There are some larvicides out on the market now that are very good to use, very environmentally friendly, but I would use those if I had to. Otherwise, I would just try and build them out by reducing the emergent vegetation,
Alicia,
or getting rid of the water.
Alicia in Brooklyn asks, are some people allergic to mosquito bites, and does scratching them make them worse?
Some people are indeed allergic to mosquito bites, and they tend to be fairer-skinned individuals. That's something that a dermatologist or a physician should be addressed. But, yes, indeed, some people are. And the actual scratching doesn't make them more allergic. It just produces an infection, possibly.
And doesn't seem to do any good because although you get instant relief, the itching comes back almost immediately.
Yes, indeed.
Does it actually exacerbate the situation?
Not to my knowledge, no.
A number of listeners have left comments asking if vitamin B1 is a natural repellent.
No, unfortunately it isn't. As a matter of fact, I was just down at the USDA laboratories a couple weeks ago with Janice Lieberman from the Today Show, and I tried a vitamin B1 patch on my arm for 2 hours and stuck my arm in a cage full of Aedes aegypti mosquitoes.
And you got bitten.
250 fed on me.
Well, we have to leave it there. I'm scratching already. Just thinking of that. Joe Conlon and Tom Scott, it's been a great pleasure talking to you today on Please Explain. We've been talking about mosquitoes.